Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive. Today, we're setting our sights on one of the most remarkable and frankly perplexing figures from late antiquity, St. Simeon Stylites the Elder.
Ah, yes, Simeon.
Imagine this, a man who, for almost four decades in the 5th century AD, lived atop a series of progressively taller pillars in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
It was an astonishing feat of human endurance, made him a global sensation back then. But for many of us today, it might seem, well, utterly bizarre.
But I think to truly understand St. Simeon, we have to look beyond the sheer spectacle of his life, you know?
Right.
As we explore his story, you'll discover he wasn't just some isolated eccentric. His pillar actually became a unique vantage point. It was a place where profound spiritual beliefs, dominant philosophical ideas, crucial geographical factors, and the intense political and theological struggles of his era all converged.
A real nexus point.
Exactly. His life offers us this extraordinary window into a world in profound transition.
So let's unpack this incredible story then. Simeon was born around 390 AD in a village called Sisan in Cilicia, a region that's now part of modern-day Turkey and Syria.
Borderlands, really?
He was a shepherd until he was about 13. Then, apparently, a powerful religious experience changed his entire trajectory.
Yes, the sources mention him hearing the Beatitudes from the Gospel of Matthew.
Specifically, blessed are they that mourn, and blessed are the pure of heart.
And an elder suggested the monastic life as a way to achieve that blessedness. That seemed to ignite something in him.
An unshakable resolve, it sounds like. His Syriac biography even recounts a vision.
It does, a vision of Christ commanding him to build a strong spiritual foundation, which, you know, certainly set the stage for what came next.
A life that could be described as an excess of piety, perhaps?
That's a good way to put it. From his very first day in the monastery at age 18, he showed this extreme zeal for asceticism. It went far beyond what was considered normal, even in that environment.
I read that account of him tying a rough palm cord.
Oh, yes. So tightly around his waist that it cut into his flesh, created this awful, festering wound.
And this was so extreme, so disruptive, that he was actually expelled from the monastery.
He was. They feared his mad feats, as they called them, would inspire weaker monks to push beyond their limits to their detriment. His intensity was just too much for community life.
After that, he really upped the ante, seeking even more radical solitude.
Mm-hmm. First, he found refuge in an empty well out in the mountains, a place where he could pursue his rigorous practices completely undisturbed.
Then he moved to a small, isolated hut near Telenisos.
That's right. And it was there he undertook his most famous pre-pillar ordeal, that 40-day Lenten fast.
Without any food or water at all.
None. His friend apparently walled up the entrance to his cell. When Simeon emerged, his survival was seen as, well, nothing short of a miracle.
And he repeated this every Lent.
Every year for the rest of his life, according to the tradition. But of course, this growing fame brought unwanted attention. Crowds started gathering.
Which completely disrupted the solitude he craved.
Exactly. And that's precisely why he pioneered Stylitism, the practice of living on a pillar.
A vertical retreat.
Pretty much. Around 423 AD, near Telenissa, he found an old pillar among some ancient ruins and decided, this is it. This will be my new home.
His first one was relatively modest, wasn't it?
Yeah, only about 3 meters high. But over the course of his life, he kept moving to successively taller columns.
Eventually reaching, what was it, 15 to 18 meters?
Something like that, 50 to 60 feet.
Yeah.
Astonishing height. And the top was tiny, just a 1 square meter platform, sometimes with a small railing or baluster.
This was his radical solution to escape the crowds, literally rising above them.
Precisely.
So what was daily life actually like on that lofty perch for, it was decades, right? 36 to 47 years, the sources vary.
It must have been incredibly grueling. We hear about constant exposure, the scorching Syrian sun, the brutal winter cold.
Wearing only animal skins.
Yes, and reportedly, even a chain around his neck at times. Most of his time was dedicated to prayer, constant prayer.
Performing thousands of prostrations daily, I read one observer counted over 1,200 before just giving up.
Imagine, this relentless physical exertion, combined with just standing there, eventually caused a severe pus-oozing ulcer on his foot. Horrific.
Yet despite all that suffering, he still made himself available to the public every afternoon.
And that's the profound paradox, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
His attempt to flee the world made him one of the most famous and ironically accessible holy men in the entire Christian world.
His pillar transformed into a kind of public square.
Absolutely. It was a pulpit where he preached, a tribunal where he judged local disputes, an international destination for pilgrims.
People climbed ladders to speak with him.
They did. And he delivered sermons twice daily to the immense crowds gathered below. He preached repentance, railed against usury, instructed his disciples, wrote letters.
His spiritual power was seen as immense.
Credited with converting thousands, yes. Including entire nomadic Arab tribes who were apparently struck by his presence and accepted baptism.
Even emperors sought his counsel.
The Eastern Roman emperors Theodosius II and Leo I, certainly. He even corresponded apparently with figures as distant as St. Genevieve of Paris. His fame was truly widespread.
Okay, this is where his story really broadens out. Simeon's individual pursuit of holiness was clearly extreme. But how did it fit, or maybe not fit, with the wider spiritual landscape of Syria at that time?
That's a crucial question. Syrian monasticism in the 4th and 5th centuries was, well, renowned for its particular intensity.
A sort of public, physically demanding piety?
Very much so.
Yeah.
It was almost a theater of holiness. Theodoret of Cyrus, who was a contemporary historian, gives us vivid descriptions.
Like what?
He talks about monks who grazed like animals, eating only what grew naturally, the boskoi. There were dendrites who lived in trees, and including monks who had themselves sealed into small cells for years, sometimes for life.
Wow. So it was a competitive environment.
Highly competitive, you could say. A kind of bloodless martyrdom where the body was seen as an adversary, something to be conquered to free the mind for God.
So Simeon's early self-laceration, the extreme fasting, it fits that pattern.
Perfectly within that Syrian model. His real innovation wasn't necessarily the severity of his asceticism, though it was severe, but the incredibly visible stage he chose for performing it.
The pillar.
The pillar.
So, stylitism wasn't just some random isolated act. You could see it as a highly sophisticated spiritual technology.
I think that's a fair way to describe it. It represents maybe the most extreme form of solitary monasticism. It combines that radical withdrawal from society with an unbreakable bond to a single chosen spot.
And the pillar itself became a powerful symbol.
Hugely powerful. Mm. A cosmic axis, perhaps, like Jacob's ladder in the Bible. Something directly connecting the earthly and the heavenly realms, acting as a conduit for prayer and divine grace.
How was this strange life understood theologically at the time?
It was primarily understood as a form of imitatio Christi Iash, a direct imitation of Christ's suffering on the cross, and also as his angelia, an angelic life.
Angelic life, how so?
By living literally between heaven and earth, exposed to the elements, dedicated to unceasing prayer, Simeon was seen by many as an incarnate angel on earth, a human who had somehow transcended the normal limitations of human existence.
And his example was influential.
Profoundly. He inspired other pillar saints, the most famous probably being Daniel the Stylite near Constantinople. And the practice actually persisted for centuries in the Eastern Church. It wasn't just a flash in the pan.
Now, beyond the immediate context of Syrian asceticism, you mentioned philosophical ideas playing a role.
Yes, and this is fascinating. The logic of Simeon's life resonates deeply with the most influential philosophical system of late antiquity, Neoplatonism.
Founded by Plotinus.
Exactly. Neoplatonism posits reality as a kind of hierarchy. Everything emanates from a single, transcendent, unknowable source called the One.
And reality sort of descends from there.
Right. Through stages, intellect, world, soul, ultimately reaching the material world. And the material world, in this view, is seen as darkness, unreality, even the source of evil.
Okay, so how does this connect specifically to Simeon climbing up a pillar?
Well, within Neoplatonism, the human soul is considered a divine spark. It's descended from that higher, intelligible realm and becomes sort of muddied or trapped by its association with a physical body.
So the goal is to get back.
Precisely. The purpose of the philosophical life is the soul's return, the epistrophe to its source, to the One. And this ascent involves purification, catharsis.
Through ascetic discipline.
Exactly. Freeing the soul from the domination of the body and the distractions of the senses. This leads to contemplation, turning the soul's attention inward to discover the divine intellect within, ideally culminating in mystical union.
So Simeon's life, it's like a physical enactment of this.
You could absolutely read it that way.
Yeah.
Climbing the pillar represents the soul's ascent from the lower material plane, the earth, the body, the distracting crowds towards the higher spiritual realm of the divine.
And moving to taller pillars.
Symbolizes that continuous journey of purification, striving ever closer to God. His unceasing prayer up there, physically removed from the world of the senses, aligns perfectly with that philosophical ideal of contemplation. It's also applied Neoplatonism, philosophy in action.
Which means the extreme physical suffering, the fasting, exposure, the ulcers, that wasn't just incidental, it was essential.
Absolutely essential to the project. Mm-hmm. If the body is the prison of the soul, the link to the unreality of the material world, that it must be subdued, disciplined, ultimately conquered for the soul to be liberated.
So a decaying body wasn't weakness, but...
It was seen as the ultimate testament to the soul's dominance. Proof that the physical form was being conquered, purged, transcended, allowing the spirit to ascend to a purer state.
Let's ground the story geographically. Where exactly was this pillar?
Simeon established his pillar on a rocky hill in the Limestone Massif. It's a hilly region in what's now northwestern Syria. It actually came to be known as Mount Simeon, Jabal Simeon, in his honor.
Near Aleppo.
About 20 kilometers northwest of Aleppo, yes, in the broader Afrin region. It's an area with a really long and diverse history.
And was the choice of location significant?
Incredibly strategic, actually. It was remote enough to fulfill that ascetic ideal of withdrawal into the wilderness.
But not completely cut off.
Exactly. It lay near a major Roman road connecting the important cities of Cyrus and Antioch, a vital artery for news, trade, and crucially, pilgrims.
Ah, access.
Plus, the surrounding landscape was fertile enough to provide the economic base needed to support the thousands of visitors, and later, the large monastic community that grew up around the site.
So it balanced solitude with practicality.
Perfectly. It allowed what started as a small hermitage to grow into this massive international phenomenon.
And after Simeon's death in 459 AD, the site was completely transformed.
Utterly. Into one of Christianity's most magnificent pilgrimage centers, Khaled Simeon, the Fortress of Simeon.
Built relatively quickly after his death.
In the decades following, yes, particularly during the reign of Emperor Zeno, the sheer scale it covered over 5,000 square meters, and the exceptional quality of the masonry and the intricate carvings, it strongly suggests elite patronage.
Likely imperial money.
Most likely. At the time it was built, it was one of the largest church complexes in the entire world.
And the architecture itself was unique?
A masterclass in Byzantine design, mm-hmm. specifically engineered for mass pilgrimage. The whole site was walled. You entered through this monumental triple-arched gate.
Leading pilgrims upwards.
Yes, up Via Sacra, a sacred processional path towards the main shrine. And the centerpiece, the martyrium, was truly unique. It's a cruciform church.
Cross-shaped.
Right, with four basilicas radiating out from a central open-air octagonal courtyard.
And in the very center of that octagon
stood the sacred focus, the remains of Simeon's pillar, open to the sky.
That design, it sounds quite practical for crowds.
Brilliantly practical. It provided four separate naves, allowing huge numbers of people to approach and view the pillar simultaneously from all directions. An incredibly effective solution for crowd management, focusing all that devotion onto that single point of sanctity.
And during its peak, say, the 5th and 6th centuries, this was a truly international destination.
Oh, absolutely. Theodoret of Cyrus, again, lists pilgrims coming from everywhere.
Oh.
Ishmaelites, Arabs, Persians, Iberians, Georgians, Himyarites, and men from even farther away, and also many from the far west, Spaniards, Britons, the Celts, and too many Italians to mention.
What were they seeking?
During Simeon's lifetime, they came to hear him preach, receive his blessing, seek healing. After his death, the faithful continued to come, circumambulating the base of his pillar, carrying on that veneration. The cult that grew up around him had its own specific rules and rituals, too.
Such as?
Well, there was a strict prohibition against women entering the main martyrium. They were restricted to the baptistry and the hostels nearby.
Really?
The reasons aren't entirely clear, but it was rigidly enforced. There's even a cautionary tale, probably apocryphal, of a woman who disguised herself in men's clothing to get in. And was supposedly struck dead as she crossed the threshold. A story that powerfully reinforced that sacred boundary, whether true or not.
What did pilgrims take away?
They took home eulogy blessings, small tokens, often made from sanctified earth or dust collected near the pillar. These were believed to offer protective and curative powers.
Like souvenirs, but holy.
Essentially, yes. And they left offerings. Over the centuries, the pillar itself was slowly whittled away.
By the faithful chipping off pieces.
Exactly. Taking tiny fragments as potent relics. Which is why it's reduced from its original towering height to the roughly 2-meter boulder you see today.
Simeon's fame was just pervasive, even in Rome.
Yes. Small icons of him were apparently placed at the entrances to workshops in Rome. His influence projected right across the Roman world.
Oh. Hannah the Chai Lady is here. Roj Bosh Hannah. Perfect timing for a little break. How's the chai today, Hannah? Is it good? Or maybe a bit bitter, needing more sugar, perhaps?
Yes. This is just what we needed. It's maybe a touch sweet for me today, actually, but it definitely hits the spot. Thanks, Hannah.
Excellent. Right. Back to our subject, Saint Simeon. Okay, so beyond the local impact at Kalat Simon and his personal journey, Simeon's influence stretched much wider, didn't it? How did a man living on top of a pillar become such a significant political and theological force in the 5th century Eastern Roman Empire?
It seems counterintuitive, but you really did. You have to remember the context of the 5th century. The Western Roman Empire was collapsing.
While the Eastern Empire, based in Constantinople, was trying to consolidate its power.
Precisely. Emperors like Theodosius II and Leo Iyer were presented as sacred figures, God's chosen regents. But their power, while theoretically absolute, was mediated by a complex court and out in the provinces, like Syria.
Imperial officials were pretty thin on the ground.
Very thin. Local cities, largely self-regulated. You could call it government without bureaucracy, in many ways. This created a kind of power vacuum at the local level.
And it was into this vacuum that charismatic figures, these holy men like Simeon, stepped in.
Exactly. They emerged as alternative but immensely powerful sources of authority, even without any official titles.
So even though Simeon held no formal position and was physically removed,
his influence rivaled any provincial governor. His spiritual prestige gave him a unique kind of power that transcended formal administration.
People brought him their disputes. He acted as a judge.
They did. And his sermons addressed pressing social issues, like usury. He became a de facto arbiter of justice and public morality.
And the imperial court noticed this.
They certainly did. And they sought to harness that power. Emperors Theodosius II, Leo I, and later Zeno are all reported to have sought his counsel, asked for his intervention in state affairs.
Why was his endorsement so valuable?
Well, in a society where the emperor's own authority was seen as divinely sanctioned, having the backing of a man widely perceived as God's direct servant, that was a political asset of incalculable value.
So by seeking his advice, the emperors gained his support.
And they also legitimized their own rule in the eyes of the Syrian population. Simeon, in turn, became this informal but highly effective instrument of imperial policy, a channel for the center's will to reach the periphery with an authority no bureaucrat could match.
Which brings us to probably the most defining conflicts of the 5th century, the Christological controversies.
Ah, yes, deep waters.
At its core, the intense question was, how do you define the relationship between the divine and the human in the person of Christ?
That's the heart of it. And there were two main schools of thought causing major friction.
The school of Antioch, where Simeon was from, right?
Generally, yes. That tradition tended to emphasize the distinction between Christ's two natures, divine and human. This position is known as diophysitism, meaning two natures.
The idea being Christ was fully God and fully human, like two distinct sides.
Sort of. Two distinct, complete natures united in one person, or prosopon. Figures like Nestorius, who became Patriarch of Constantinople, were associated with this view. They often preferred the term Christotokos, Christ-bearer for Mary, arguing she bore the human Jesus, not the eternal Godhead itself.
And the other side?
That was the school of Alexandria, led by the formidable Patriarch Cyril. They championed a view emphasizing the profound unity of Christ after the incarnation.
Cyril's formula was one incarnate nature.
Teumiophysis of God, the word, yes. For the Alexandrians, any talk of two natures after the incarnation risked splitting Christ apart, making him seem like two separate beings.
And they insisted on Theotokos.
Passionately defended it, God-bearer for Mary. Their position, stressing the singular unity of Christ's person, came to be known historically as monophysitism, though its adherents usually preferred miaphysitism, one united nature.
This theological struggle led to a series of major church councils.
It dominated the century. The First Council of Ephesus in 431 saw Cyril basically outmaneuver his opponents, leading to the condemnation of Nestorius.
Then there was the chaotic robber council in 449.
Which was widely seen as illegitimate. But the really decisive one was the Council of Chalcedon in 451, convened by Emperor Marcion. It aimed to settle the matter definitively.
And its definition of faith declared.
It declared Christ to be one person, one unified individual or hypostasis. But within this one person, he possessed two complete and distinct natures. One fully divine, one fully human.
United how?
United unconfusedly, unchangeably, indivisibly, inseparably. Meaning the natures never got mixed up or changed. They retained their separate properties, yet they always acted as one single subject.
How was this received?
It was accepted in Rome and Constantinople, becoming the standard imperial orthodoxy. But it was fiercely rejected by the majority of Christians in Egypt and also in large parts of Syria.
Why the rejection?
For many in the East, the Chalcedonian formula of Christ existing in two natures sounded dangerously close to the condemned Nestorius. It felt like a betrayal of Cyril of Alexandria's emphasis on unity.
And this led to a permanent split.
A permanent schism, yes. The anti-Chalcedonians eventually formed their own separate ecclesiastical structures, which would evolve into traditions like the Coptic Orthodox Church in Egypt and the Syriac Orthodox Church.
And those who accepted Chalcedon.
They became known as Melkites, literally the emperor's men, because they followed the imperial definition. Syria, as a result, was deeply fractured, theologically and politically.
And in this deeply divided landscape, where did St. Simeon Stylites stand?
He stood as a powerful and unwavering champion of the Chalcedonian cause, the imperial cause.
Really? From his pillar?
Absolutely. He used his immense moral authority to defend the imperial Orthodox position. He's credited with confirming the faith of many who had been swayed by Miaphysite arguments, including even Empress Eudocia, the influential widow of Theodosius II.
So his preaching included theology.
It did. And perhaps his most famous political act was the letter he sent to Emperor Leo III, unequivocally supporting the Chalcedonian definition. That letter was treated with the utmost respect at court, read out publicly.
So his pillar became a symbol of orthodoxy.
A highly visible, unassailable bastion of imperial orthodoxy, you could say. And the later imperial patronage of Kalat Simon, especially under Zeno, looks like a very calculated political investment.
Using Simeon's enduring cult.
To propagate state-sanctioned orthodoxy in a region rife with dissent. His sanctity was weaponized, in a sense, for political theological ends.
So when we look at St. Simeon Stylites, what we really have is a figure who defies any easy categorization.
Completely. A radical recluse who somehow became a global celebrity. A contemplative whose fame grew directly from extreme physical mortification.
His life was shaped by so many powerful currents.
Syrian asceticism, Neoplatonic philosophy, strategic geography, the tumultuous politics and theology of late antiquity.
And he was right in the middle of it all.
But he wasn't just passively shaped by them.
No, not at all. He was an active agent. He invented this new, compelling form of asceticism stylitism. And by lending his immense prestige to the Chalcedonian cause, he played a really crucial role in that great schism that would define the future of Eastern Christianity for centuries to come. And his magnificent shrine, Kalat Simen,
became a permanent monument to his influence. It profoundly shaped the religious, economic, and political life of the Near East for a very long time. He was, as one scholar put it, the conscience and spiritual example for Syrian Christians in the patristic period.
He remains a difficult saint, doesn't he? Precisely because his life forces us to confront the absolute outermost limits of faith, of penance, of human endurance.
He really challenges us. Challenges us to reckon with the profound, maybe unsettling power of a faith that would drive someone to leave the world, not by going away, but simply by going up.
His solution, the pillar, was so extreme, so visually arresting.
That it's made him an archetype of religious driving, hasn't it? Across cultures, across centuries.
Which leaves us with a question, maybe.
Yeah.
What does it mean for us today, living in such a different world, to seek, as his biography put it, spiritual foundations of extraordinary strength and endurance? And what kind of ascension, if any, might that involve for you?
A powerful thought to consider indeed.
Thank you for joining us on this look into the world of St. Simeon Stylites here on the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.